This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 528. On today's show, Rachel Tillman and I circle back to discuss Sally Rooney's first novel, Conversations with Friends. So as you probably know, this show is kind of my continuing Master of Fine Arts degree in creative writing, and one of the unspoken assumptions of most MFA programs is that the focus of such work is literature. You might get away with a literary approach to other genres, but you aren't likely to be able to write pulp or anything that is merely adequate genre work in such programs. The programs that have a more genre-specific focus or focuses usually advertise this fact, so that if you want to write YA or fantasy or YA fantasy or science fiction or detective fiction, you'll know that you can do that there. My show, much like my life though, focuses mostly on literature. If I am going to cheat on literature, I usually will cheat with film rather than other genre fiction, usually. So those are my fellow literature aficionados. Happy belated Blooms Day! June 16th is the day James Joyce's Ulysses is set on, and James Joyce nerds around the world gather in Dublin and New York and in rare years, Orlando, Florida, to read from the novel. No gathering reads the whole novel. I doubt the novel can be read in a day unless one is deep into a marathon of cocaine use, which I don't recommend, especially in today's climate of hyperinflation. Bloomsday should feel like a party, as they do at Ulysses Folk House in downtown Manhattan. I attended those gatherings when I lived in New York City, when I was earning my MFA at NYU, from 2007 to 2010. At that gathering, I met my dear friend Christopher Booth, who sometimes makes announcements on this show. I also got to hear Sam Shepard read a page or two from Ulysses. That might be on my Bloomsday video on TDO's YouTube channel. Ulysses delves deep into the mind of three characters: Leopold Bloom, a Jewish advertising salesman, his opera singer of a wife, Molly Bloom, and Stephen Dedalus, who was the star of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. I've done three Bloomsday shows for The Drunken Odyssey, including an in-studio one I am quite proud of that was all the way back on episode 104. Another milestone I didn't stop to notice lately is that of June 10th, when The Drunken Odyssey officially turned 10 years old. I think that means someone needs to hold an intervention for me so that I stop doing this. This podcast has been running as long as it took Odysseus to get home from the Trojan War. What do you think, dear listeners? Leave a comment in this episode's page over at thedrunkenodyssey.com or email me at thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. I've been doing some editing and other professional contact work this week, which is part of the writing process. I need to remember to be proud of doing the boring parts of the writing life as well as the exciting bits. Soon I will write, words. All right, let's talk to Rachel about Sally Rooney.
And now, the interview of the day.
Welcome, dear listeners, to A Conversation with a Friend about Conversation with Friends, the Sally Rooney novel. I am back once again with Rachel Tillman. So we talked about Sally Rooney's novels a while back, and both of us technically failed in our homework in that we didn't complete Conversations with Friends. So this is kind of a revisited because I don't know if it's literary guilt or if we were just that drawn to Sally Rooney's work, but we went back and completed our homework assignment. So what was your experience going back and finishing the book?
Well, with Sally Rooney, I don't really feel that we failed in our homework assignment. It's just simply we were looking at two of her...
We didn't get an A+.
No, but nor did we fail.
No, all right.
We didn't quite fail, but...
At least a solid B.
B+, yeah. I do think I understand Conversations with Friends a little bit better because I went into Normal People, which was one of her most visible works, and Beautiful World, Where Are You?, which is her most recent. And I think, was this her debut novel? I think it...
Yeah.
This was her debut novel, and working backward, which I've done with authors before, you read their newest stuff first and then you go from there. I do feel like her work has definitely evolved, and I know there was a lot of hype around this one. I liked it. I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. I read the synopsis, and I was like, okay, this isn't exactly fresh or original grounds. It's not an insult. I'm just saying it's about a brilliant, intelligent college student, you know, having an affair with an older, handsome, depressed, married man. This is something that's, you know, it's been trod before. This path is not new, but I liked it. I liked it.
So unlike her other novels, this one is written in first person.
Yes, and I enjoyed it simply because you are very much in Frances's head the entire time, and you really do get a deeper perspective of the how and why of something that could be very banal. You know, a 21-year-old, you know, college senior or university senior having an affair with a man in his 30s who's a professional actor. I think, as strange as it sounds, if it was from an omniscient point of view, I think a lot of the nuance would be lost. But because you're very much living in Frances's head with her, you understand her motivation. You really see where she's coming from. You get the impression she sort of, I don't want to say gets passed over, but she very much feels like someone who is brilliantly in the background of her own life.
Well, that's the way she sees it.
That's the way she sees it.
One of the common themes, I think, in Sally Rooney's work is just what William James referred to as just the, I'm not going to quote him, but the absolute inability, impossibility of understanding another human being.
Mm.
And I think he's being relative there. Like, there are levels of not understanding, but it's almost impossible to feel like you're truly, deeply seen and understood by another human being. And I think we overlook how difficult that is, and people who are aware of how difficult that is can be tortured by this. And I think that is what's happening with a lot of Sally Rooney's characters. And in third person, that can come off as infuriating. I think I described Normal People like a horror story. Like, no, go, don't come back. Don't do that. Like, and even though I can see Frances, our narrator, in Conversation with a Friend doing something similar, because it's so immediate and because she seldom sees herself, right? And so her impressions are kind of dominating her experience, which is the way human beings experience the world. And hopefully our friends can be somewhat complimentary and somewhat healthy critics as mirrors of our lives, that we can make fewer mistakes and that maybe we have a better sense of whether or not we're understood. So I feel like the first person, I don't know about nuance, I would love to hear you talk more about that. But for me, it's because we lack that distance from Frances, we can actually feel that distortion in a way that feels much more lived in. So that I'm not yelling at Frances, don't do that. I'm like, I know why you're doing that, and I've done similar things.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's a major upside to the first person. Even if you're Sally Rooney, I imagine having total strangers over and over again assume that you are your narrator would make you go, all right, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah. Although Frances does seem very much a cipher for Sally Rooney. I mean, I kind of feel like, okay, this is very much her. The one thing I really like what you said about seeing other people, because strangely enough, I feel Frances doesn't wholly see everyone, but they don't wholly see anyone else. I mean, about the quartet, you know, Nick and Melissa and Bobby and Frances, is that...
All right, well, let's pause and...
Yeah.
Just explain, who are these people?
Oh my goodness, sorry. Okay, so for people who have not read, our protagonist is Frances. There is her best friend, Bobby, who she has known since high school. And Bobby, by the way, is another young woman. Also, Frances's ex-girlfriend. Bobby identifies herself as gay, whereas Frances is bisexual. Melissa is a photographer and writer who sees them at their spoken word performance and is interested in doing a profile on them. She's very successful in her field. She's in her late 30s. Nick is...
Well, she's a rising star in her field.
She's a rising star in her field.
Her position is enough for her to feel anxious about...
True.
So, depending on your point of view, like either like she's wildly successful or she's just getting started, but could get knocked down at any moment.
Yeah, well, with any creative who's a photographer and a writer, her husband Nick is an actor of, I guess, stage and screen and the small screen.
Mostly theater, but enough TV and enough film for him to, have some slight amount of fame, but also handsome, so that.
Yeah.
People see him and they're like, oh,
yeah,
that's a thing.
Yeah, he's described, I think, at some point as like a B-list actor, not as an insult, but someone who sort of like fame, full-on fame, never quite arrived. And
not too late.
No, not too late, but he hasn't quite gotten there yet. You know, no one's sending him to the Oscars.
Yeah, and so Kathy Griffin's joke is she's a D-lister.
Mm. Yeah, when of course she's more like a B, you know.
Somewhere between a B and a C, but yeah. Because she's so disreputable, like that could bounce her down to a D.
Possibly.
The beheading of Trump photo, I think.
Yeah, that was a lot.
Made her a political hero to a lot of people, and I thought it was funny. But I also see how, I don't know, whoever the hell watches CNN might find it concerning.
Yeah, I think she would have been very much at home with a Dada and surrealist movement.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. But not Sally Rooney. No, she's...
I would have a difficult time predicting what Sally Rooney might think. I mean, I think I can guess easily things she might be critical of.
Mm.
But that's not the same as saying, oh, I think I know how she thinks. Like, I would really want to wait to hear what she actually has to think about things.
I would never presume. I think it'd be incredibly intimidating to talk to her about her books, for me, personally. She can come across as very... I don't want to say standoffish in interviews, but someone who is very much wrapped up in her own head and sort of the own, you know, her writing, the world that she lives in. She's very, I wouldn't say she's not happy with the fame and the recognition and the fortune that comes with it, but she's very critical of it. That's what I was looking for. She's very critical of her critical recognition.
Well, it's complicated.
It is. There's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly valid.
So... For every question that gets asked, there's like a whole foundation of assumptions underneath that question.
Hmm.
And to someone of a self... Are we being attacked? Oh, it was a lizard.
It was. See, I told you I saw something.
I didn't say you were wrong.
Okay. All right. Godspeed, little lizard.
I didn't contradict you. I just... Sorry, we've had a visitor here at the secret headquarters.
Yes.
So... I think for a lot of writers, interviews seem like booby traps. Like Mary Carr, I've interviewed. It's one of the few interviews that I really prepared for other than just reading the books.
Yeah.
Because she's written three memoirs, four if you count The Art of Memoir, which is a memoir about writing memoirs.
Hmm.
And
how meta.
She really turns herself inside out. And if she made a living writing poetry, she would never bother writing those memoirs. She doesn't like writing them. She doesn't want to write them. And it's the thing that she's overwhelmingly known for. And people want to ask her questions about the memoir. And it's like, well, the answer is in the fucking memoir. Just leave me alone. So she would rather joke.
Yeah.
And be entertaining. And I kind of endorse that. Tom Waits has a tendency to just invent mythological explanations for things rather than answer a simple question, because he finds the simple question, as often as not, boring, but you get him pointed in a direction he likes and he may forget to make stuff up. Part of the conflict with just doing an interview, Chuck Klosterman wrote a whole book just about the whole epistemological problem of doing interviews, which kind of, I think that's why I drank so much at the beginning of the show, is so I could stop thinking about what interviews meant and just do the interviews. Yeah, with Mary Carr, I didn't ask her emotionally exploitative questions. There was one NPR interview where she's just badgered over and over again. Mm. Like, I think the interviewer from NPR just wanted her to cry because David Foster Wallace died, because she knew him, and he's in the memoir Lit, he's David. And it's like, oh, that David. Like, yes, that David. And it turns out that David was a monster when he was dealing with, or not dealing with, untreated mental illness and drug addiction. And I think the Saint David that I and so many other people fell in love with, and I'm still in love with, but I think that's him in significant part trying to atone for a lot of what happened when he was trying to get a grip on these things, or maybe not even, you know, like egotistically thinking he didn't have to.
Yeah.
And I hope that there's nothing quite so fraught in Sally Rooney's past, that that's what she's dealing with in interviews. But on the other hand, yeah, I could see how for some writers, like most interviews are just a trial.
Well, also you have to consider that even though the interviewer is supposed to be completely unbiased, nevertheless, I know, supposed to be completely unbiased, they nevertheless are going in there with the intention to create a very specific image of whoever they're interviewing, whether it's for their own personal reasons, whether it's to reach out to the audience that they write for. Like, for instance, when you have maybe The Atlantic interviewing Sally Rooney, it's going to craft a very specific Sally Rooney, but you might have Vogue interviewing Sally Rooney because they also interview writers, and even that Sally Rooney is going to be a creation of that interviewer. So yeah, no, I agree. It can be a total minefield. And this is understandable. A lot of writers don't necessarily like talking about their work. Some do, but not necessarily. I've heard the phrase talk it to death or talk it till it's dead. And there are so many things about what they write, whether poetry, essays, prose, a memoir, anything like that, where you really just have to sit down and read it. I can say, you know, I know not everyone has read Conversations with Friends, but you would think that an interviewer would know their subject. Do you know, kind of do that, because the answer is the memoir. It's in the book. It's in the poems. So it's a fair point.
And I like interviews, hopefully, to be fun, not homework. And yet, through no fault of my own, I could create that situation.
Possibly. I don't want to say every single interviewer sets out to, you know, antagonize their subjects.
No. Well, and I think there are writers who just know, like, I'm talked out. Like, it won't be fun for anybody, so I simply can't do it. And I'm totally ecstatic with that. As an interviewer, I'm like, great. Like, if you ever want to talk, I'd be happy to talk. But, like, if you think it's just a bad idea, then I'm happy to let it go. I'm equally happy to let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and sometimes a lot of authors, they will.
Rachel Tillman will still talk to me. So as long as I have that.
Yes, I will still talk to you. Yes, clearly.
At least one more time.
At least one more time. Yeah. Although if I have my way, I have several other subjects I would like to talk about, but that's a bit self-serving. So
yeah, Melissa is supposed to be doing this magazine profile or newspaper profile on Francis and Bobby, who are a successful spoken word duo, whatever that means.
Well,
I'm guessing that means they have some notoriety on the campus where they perform, which is a certain kind of fame.
Yeah, they have the TV show actually did show them. See, that's one thing. If you read the book, you don't actually...
You never hear a word of it.
You never hear a word of it. You just know that everyone loves it. They get applause. Because I haven't really gone recently, but I've been involved in the spoken word scene in Orlando. I remember watching those scenes in the Hulu adaptation, thinking, okay, this is about a 7, but they perform in pubs. I don't necessarily think it's not necessarily on campus, but it's enough for Melissa to find them interesting. Especially, I imagine the topics that they're speaking about, they're performing about, are ones that would have to do with, you know, being a young woman, being an intelligent young woman, being self-possessed in this day and age, where being intelligent and self-possessed, weirdly enough, isn't always a good thing for other people.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Especially when you're young.
Oh, definitely.
I pissed some people off so much. It's like a lifetime of agita. And I probably was totally insufferable in grad school when I started.
Isn't everyone insufferable in grad school?
I think I may have been a special case even in that category. Yeah, so in between undergrad and grad school, so I was 22, 23, so I'm a year or so older than these two characters. But I had long hair, and I'm tired of waking up with hair in my mouth, so I cut my hair and decided, all right, so now it's no longer heavy metal and long hair, it's jazz and suits. And so I started wearing suits, and so I loved postmodernism and modernism and literary theory, and so I was just this monster, and that I was dressing in suits in South Florida just seemed like insane to people. And clearly, like, as an undergrad, I felt, I don't know, like, this is supposed to be my jam, and it's not quite, this isn't the apotheosis. This is like a six of an experience. And then in grad school, it's like, oh, this is the 10 I've been waiting for, when other people who were in undergrad and thought they were living a 10 are now living a six. And they're like, what the fuck is up with that guy? So to some degree, I kind of get how exciting and also how maybe frustrating Francis and Bobby may have seen, especially to Melissa, who needed content to write about. And also, she's a photographer, and so she's taking photographs. And there is the question, well, if these were not two strong photographic subjects, would she still be interested?
That's true, because, again, if you haven't read the novel, not really much of a spoiler, but Bobby is supposed to be very attractive, quite stunning. And even though Frances describes herself as plain, I feel it's sort of like that. I can't quite describe it, but it's a very specific aesthetic of a girl who calls herself plain, but she's not actually plain. She's just not conventionally attractive. From what I imagine, I always sort of, I guess kind of as a default, sort of imagine a Sally Rooney-esque character. But they are compelling. And, you know, and I was thinking about, you know, our brains really don't finish developing till we're, what was it, in our mid-20s. We're still essentially developing from a cognitive point, correct?
I'm sorry, were you saying something?
Ba-dum-pooch.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And there is that sort of that unformed view with Bobby and Frances. You know, they're sort of still very much processing the world when they themselves are not quite finished. And I don't mean that in a devastating sense. But
and yet their educations are furnishing them with this rich vocabulary with which to describe the world and the way that the world works, which allows them to be very dismissive of so much of what they see around them while they're still figuring out who they are. And I also get the sense Bobby, because she's so beautiful, and everybody seems impressed by this, that she sees the world, including the people in it, as something largely to be toyed with.
Yeah, she's kind of a lot as a character. Also, another thing, she's quite well off. Her family is, they're quite rich. This is not someone with student loans. You know, her rent, she can always pay her rent. She's quite fashionable. So in a sense, and in a way, kind of Frances is not necessarily from the same background, but is still incredibly privileged as well. So for two young people who very much want to be in the world, there's still this filter on the both of them. What I was saying about cognitive development and emotional maturity and all that, looking back, it's like, yeah, someone who's a highly intelligent 21-year-old who does spoken word, who lives in an apartment, and I'm guessing is what a somewhat bohemian part of Dublin, could see having an affair with a 30-something-year-old actor as sort of part of that, you know, wild tapestry of their life, even though the affair itself seems a lot of work, as most of them are. And
I wouldn't know. I've never been tempted.
Oh, it's again.
Oh, the pain. No.
no, but it's you sort
so
of.
He's in his early 30s, by the way. He's not like 38.
Really? I always got. Well, you know what? See, that's it. They always treat Bobby and Frances always treat Nick as middle aged. But the sad thing is he's.
But they're 21.
But yeah. They're 21.
So if he's 31, that's like 51. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, wait a minute. Nick is younger than I am. Nick and Melissa, they're both younger than I am. It's like, but yeah, I think they would still nevertheless see that as part of their world. If I can kind of articulate this quite clearly, is that you feel like if Frances didn't do it, Bobby would as well. Because you're right. Bobby does sort of see the larger world as something to be played with. And she is, again, she's a lot, and she's can be quite selfish and overbearing. I think if I knew her in real life, she'd drive me crazy.
unless she was an ex-girlfriend who you still had some feelings for because she's so damn gorgeous. And because, you know,
deep down inside there,
she does care, even if you have to wonder, what does that mean to her exactly? Mm-hmm. But on the basic merits, Bobby seems like an awfully toxic person, entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
So in some ways, Francis feels like maybe like one of the Joker's henchmen who really kind of likes watching the Joker work.
Yeah.
So when they are brought into the world of Nick and Melissa, it's like, oh, Francis goes, oh, you could fit a whole family in this house, which turns out to be a more important statement in the context of the whole book.
Yeah.
But they're entering this kind of foreign world to them, and Bobby has designs on Melissa, even if, like, is Melissa, like, all right, Melissa's married, presumably mm-hmm. monogamous, also probably straight, and, like, Bobby is like, oh, details, details.
Yeah. Yeah, I will see that. That's another thing that you bring up is the fact that Melissa and Nick are very much adults living in an adult world.
Oh,
I mean, from I see this in the most superficial way.
They have the trappings of.
They have the trappings of. Yes, thank you. The trappings of adulthood. They live in a nice house in a decent neighborhood. They have friends and they throw really nice parties. And they apparently have one heck of a wine cellar. And they travel for work. And it's sort of, even though Bobby is sort of from that rarefied sphere, you get the impression she's very much been living a student life. And then seeing that close up, it's, I don't want to say it's a bit like Mars, but it's a bit like walking on the moon. It's entering this whole other world that people live like this. This is real. This is a thing, especially if the world you are in is very student-y, very middle class, maybe not quite perfect. Actually, Francis and Bobby, one thing they have in common, their parents' marriage is in complete shambles, and Francis's father is an alcoholic. Bobby's mother sounds like she struggles with mental health issues. So they're not exactly coming from perfect backgrounds. And you know, you see kind of how Francis and Bobby are reacting to that in very different ways overall.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very difficult for Francis, but Bobby finds it, I don't want to say perversely amusing, but it's like, oh, her dad, you know, dad's my favorite, you know. It's just mom being hysterical again, you know, in the room with the yellow wallpaper, freaking out about nothing. whereas, you know, the scenes with Francis's father when she visits him in his squalid, filthy home where there are literally maggots and vermin, that is real and unpleasant and solid. And people who have parents like that deal with real things and shame and loss and not knowing how to love someone, love a parent. And well, with Frances, it's like she loved Bobby and she loves her mother and she doesn't know if she loves her father. It's like, I don't want to use the phrase learning how to love. That's so cliched, but it's a very different type of love that is not based on family or friends, but is wholly from the outside. It's unexpected. She really has to love Nick from a different place, if you see where I'm coming from on that.
Well, and part of it is learning how to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, part of the problem is there are conversations with friends and not conversations with lovers.
Yeah, and there's conversations, but no. But is anyone communicating? Is anyone really doing that? That's a question. So.
Well, a lot of it is performative. Like, okay, here are my Marxist theories, and like, we're okay. And so they're kind of fun conversations, but then Bobby might emotionally humiliate you just to see what will happen.
Yeah.
And then we'll play dumb if you, you know, complain.
Yeah. I think between Bobby and Francis, Bobby is the most overtly charming and dynamic. But looking back, I actually reread this on my morning commute. Lots of reading time. You understand why Nick might actually be drawn to Francis, because she's not perfect, but she has substance and depth and her own beauty. And she doesn't seem, she takes things for granted, but not in a way Bobby does. And she has real things that have crafted her life, and including them is her relationship with Bobby, which I think Bobby is very flippant about. Whereas for Francis, it was so pivotal in who she is. So I got that.
So early in the book, it's set up, okay, so Bobby is aiming for Melissa, and Francis nothing happens between Bobby and Melissa. And then shockingly, Francis and Nick have an affair, and it's not a casual affair. Like, hey, here's some mechanical sex because there's time for it and there's enough privacy to get away with it. He's deeply drawn to Francis, and it takes a long time for why that is to come through. But I think a lot of it has to do with how cold Francis is. And I don't mean to say that she doesn't have any emotions. In fact, no, she has plenty of emotions, but
chapters worth.
It's not directed like a fire hose most of the time. And so to Nick, who suffers from depression and maybe doesn't know what he wants out of the world.
Yeah.
And Melissa is like, come on, do something. Come on, tell me what you think. Come on, tell me. And it's like that. I've been in relationships like that where that's exhausting. Like, what are you thinking? It's like, I don't want to be thinking. That's what I'm thinking. Thinking I just want to lay down and not think for a couple of days. That's what I absolutely need right now. Okay, well, what are you thinking now? It's like, what do you do on day two of that situation?
Yeah. And I think
lots of alcohol and yelling. That's part of it.
Exactly.
Which is why you got to go.
Yeah.
You can't stay in a situation like that.
Well, it actually, the one thing that the book does dwell on is the fact that Melissa has actually had a few flings. This is not, I mean, it's maybe not necessarily the first time Nick has had a flirtation, but I got the impression that Melissa did not know or expect it to go that far. I mean, she had things going on, and Nick is depressed and he's very charming. There's a really uncomfortable scene later on where they're all in the south of France, as one does, and they talk about...
If you're in a Sally Rooney novel and you're traveling through Europe, don't.
Oh, yeah, no. They're always... Oh, that's true. That comes up a lot. Like, just don't. Just don't travel if you're in... If you are in a Sally Rooney novel, do not travel. But there's a really uncomfortable scene where they talk about Nick having a crush on a Starbucks worker at an airport. And I actually felt really bad for Nick because it was clearly an uncomfortable subject, and it was dinner party fodder. It was to add a bit of fun and humor and to...
Remember when that prole thought you were actually on a date with her?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's also a really good example of, like, house party vacations. Why I don't go on them. You know, I mind you, I don't know anyone who has a home in the south of France. But it's like, this is what we try to avoid, you know? We don't do this.
Conversation with friends.
Yes, yes.
Because once there are too many friends, too many ways it can go wrong.
Exactly. And I mean, even if they weren't having an affair, I feel like it would still be just a very uncomfortable situation on a different level. But it does, I think, give Francis insight into how Nick and Melissa work on an everyday basis, because they're sort of housekeeping. You know, they're doing the grocery shopping, they're running errands, they're getting the house ready, they're doing things during the day. She's around them in a way that she hasn't been before. She can't escape their lives as a couple, even though they're in completely separate bedrooms, which, yeah, that was... I guess it makes sense, given what was going on with the two of them. But then you have to wonder, like, why are Melissa and Nick even together? Like, I guess they make each other happy?
Well, I think that they're maybe smart enough and wise enough to realize they need to figure out why they're breaking up if they're breaking up.
Mm.
Like, full-on divorce, it's a lot of work.
It is.
And
it
I think, though we could go with... Melissa's argument that Nick is just too damn passive, and so if it's up to him to decide anything, nothing will ever get decided.
Yeah. Well, she even, Melissa eventually writes Francis an email, a very long email explaining...
After everything comes out,
by the way, as you knew they would eventually, basically saying, you know, I'm not divorcing him. I don't know if you expect to be the next... What is his last name? Conway? The next Mrs. Nick, for lack of a better word, and kind of a little bit more insight into who she's been with. It's like, this is how he is. You know, if you've made him happy, he seems happier. Congratulations, great. But it was one of those things like, you're not the first and you're probably not going to be the last. I'm feeling a little hurt. You're a bit cold. You're a bit standoffish. You know, you're a Marxist who's enjoying incredible wealth on a secondhand basis and privilege. So it was many paragraphs of Melissa basically saying you need to check yourself, basically, in as many words.
Yeah, a strange passive-aggressive female that seems both kind but also like an enemy dossier. Like, oh, by the way, here's what we've learned all about you and your world and what you think is happening.
Yeah.
some of it kindly given and some of it spitefully given.
Yeah, it was so passive aggressive. You feel that if like an angry conversation, very angry conversation and confrontation would have probably been better than this email that just like you read it and it's just like your intestines are on the floor, you know, and you didn't feel a thing. But that's what she's done. She's kind of just gutted you as a person. And she's shown your affair for what it is. And Melissa knows she's not perfect. You know, she's had her own indiscretions. But that Frances needs to get real about whatever she thinks is going on with Nick.
Dear listeners, this is your friend, Chris Booth. If you have enjoyed this program, which comes to you absolutely free, and are wondering what you might do to support this show, please, please, please write a review of the podcast on iTunes, comment on the website, and most of all, tell your friends. If you buy books online, please click on the Powell's link on the left-hand side of the website. Doing so will grant this show a small commission on anything you purchase, at no expense at all to you, and help support both a wonderful podcast and a wonderful brick-and-mortar independent bookstore in Portland, Oregon. If you must use the services of the metastasizing mega-corporate empire Amazon.com, then there is a similar link to Amazon further down the page on the left-hand side. You fiends. Thank you for listening. I will now resume drinking. Ever yours, Christopher.
Hi, this is John Waters, and you're listening to The Drunken Odyssey. Keep on listening, or I'll have you killed.
That email, though, that Melissa sends to Frances also reveals to us how Melissa saw Frances. As this beautiful, young, intoxicating, opinionated, sneering hipster who
basically
mocked everything in Melissa's life, which almost none of that seemed to be functioning in terms of the way Frances was regarding the way that Melissa lived her life, had a little bit to do probably with the subjects that what might come out of Frances's mouth, although probably had more to do with Frances smiling at the snide things Bobby was saying. So a lot of this is probably being triangulated through Bobby. That's my guess.
Yeah.
Either that, or this is all things that Melissa's projecting onto Frances. Frances being plain probably isn't the word. Like plain, maybe standing next to Bobby. But on the other hand, if you seem smarter than the charming, you know, fabulous talky person, for some people, the quieter person ends up being the way more intriguing person.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm going to very briefly kind of coast into a completely different novel, The Custom of the Country by Edith Wharton. I swear it's relevant. Where Undine Spragg, who is a society beauty, multiple divorcee, and a friend of hers tells her that when she comes in and all eyes are on her, her looks and her physique and her jewels and her clothes, and, you know, men just go open mouth. But then she starts talking, and it's a bit anticlimactic. And she kind of tells Undine, you're kind of a little dumb, not like stupid, but you're just not quite all there. Like, you don't really read. And I think with, you know, it's funny, it's almost like we discover that Melissa has also seen Frances, because we, as the reader, don't really know a whole lot about Melissa. We know she's a writer, she's a photographer, she's married to Nick, she has a nice house. Her editor-in-chief lets her stay at her villa in France, which we should all be so lucky when we become writers.
Except that this is a horrible person who's doing us a favor.
Yes. That woman was a lot.
And so Melissa, from Frances's point of view, has the perfect life and yet seems a bit conventional, a bit boring, a bit underwhelming.
Which is a disservice to Melissa, I think. There's nothing, there's very little that's boring about her. For me, at least, the reader.
I would love an appendix where we actually get to read the work of both of these writers. So we can, like, that would turn this into an evil parlor game of, I don't know, literary intrigue. But you are right, Melissa may may very well be 10 times the person that Frances seems to think she is. But even then, the worst we could say about Frances is, yeah, she's mildly successful and more conventional than she wants to be.
Hmm. You could argue then, can you really have it two ways? I mean, there is a certain, if you really want to be successful in your field and you want to enjoy the trappings of that success, it kind of goes without saying that there will be conventional aspects of your life. Do you think that's fair? I mean, you know, not everyone can be a raging iconoclast, you know, shuffling around their almost hoarder level, you know, apartment building or house. I mean, you could argue if you do want that certain level of recognition, you also have to accept the conventional. If you see what I mean, like there's always going to be conventional aspects of fame and recognition and things that they allow you to do and to have and to be. And they can be comforting, especially if you really struggled to get where you are. I mean, you're a writer, and I'm a writer who's probably more frightened of critics than I should be. Everyone tells me I shouldn't be, but I don't really get my work out there as much simply because of that.
Well, if critics are writing about you, that means they're paying attention.
True.
Which is a step up from where almost everyone is.
Exactly. And you know, it could also be argued that, you know, Frances sees her future in Melissa. Do you think that's also a fair observation? Like, especially if Frances does become a poet, a writer, an essayist, that she could be Melissa.
So, yeah, in the story, Frances writes poetry for these spoken word performances, in which I think Bobby sometimes plays the ukulele. In my mind, I keep wanting to go to Garfunkel and Oates, even though I think... That's a very high standard, I think, for anybody to accomplish.
Yeah, there's a ukulele in
there. Those
two
are geniuses.
They are brilliant.
They are absolute geniuses. And I think that spoken word poetry would have to become astronomically better generally to even approach what they're doing with their lyrics.
Yes.
Or book poets or academic, like any, like what they're doing is so ingenious. I love them so much. So Frances is like at the fringe of a fringe of a fringe activity.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think because the two of them are probably dishy looking, and because Bobby is a dynamic performer who is really charismatic, and so Frances writes the good work. She kind of participates in the performance, mm-hmm. but Bobby kind of helps sell the whole thing.
Yeah. And they're doing it in these incredible Irish accents. Yeah.
And then she goes and writes... You saw the TV show. So then she goes ahead and writes this story, and she ends up getting in touch with, this literary personage who has helped Melissa so much. So in some ways, Frances is being groomed for the kind of exact trajectory that Melissa's on, where, okay, you're in the weeds, and you're brilliant, so we're going to move you into the mainstream, and now you're going to owe this horrible person favors, which means when she behaves abominably, there's a ceiling on how much you can criticize that person because you owe them, and you know that you owe them.
Yeah. And this is also important because it's the practicalities of being a writer is that Frances is offered 800 euro for her story. And at this point, the money that she's supposed to get from her father to carry for the academic year to pay for her schooling and groceries and the essentials and money to live off of has not arrived, which could be actually quite disastrous. She has to, you know, get help from the university to pay for her schooling. She's barely buying groceries. She's in a really precarious position. And when you are offered 800 euro, which is over 1,000 US dollars, even at this point, there's that practicality that I can make a living off of it. And I don't want to say a desperation, but it's...
Well, it's the difference between being desperate and not desperate.
Exactly. Exactly. And she even tells, you know, she finally tells Bobby, like, hey, I have to work for a living. I have to work. I need a job, you know. And Bobby's never had a job at this point.
Why would she have a job?
Yeah, I know. But it's like they're in their early 20s. And I know this is kind of a weird sort of, I don't want to say elitism, but if I met someone in their early 20s who had never had a job, I'd be lying if my eyebrows wouldn't go up, especially this day and age. So it's like a weird sort of sense of superiority. It's like, oh, well, I had my first job as a teenager. I've had many jobs since, but you've never had one? What's wrong with you? And when she kind of has to tell Bobby, like, look, this could be my living, and if this is my living, live with it. You know, she doesn't want to ask Nick for handouts.
But her story was about Bobby.
Oh, yeah. And I actually want to read it. I want Sally Rooney to write about Bobby because I want to see why Bobby got in a huge strop, stormed out. And again, going in the concept of actually seeing, I think maybe it showed that Bobby, that Francis knew her. Not just in the biblical sense, but Francis really knew who she was as a person, put it on paper that will be read by others. And I think it was an honest, candid, and not wholly flattering image. And no one want, if someone were to write about me honestly, I don't think I would like it. It would be compelling, and I would either want to correct them or support them or confirm that. And I think Frances did that. It was very unsettling for Bobby.
Well, it should have been.
Yeah, that was the whole point. She kind of had it coming.
She did, but also it's a terrible thing to do.
It is.
If I were somehow to write a story in which you were a character prominently featured, would I feel compelled to put any flaws I see? I don't know. I do know that if I thought the story would go anywhere, it would be important to me that I picked flaws you might be proud of so that you could go, oh, all right, I have these flaws.
It's like, I know, I'm impatient and silently judgy and occasionally short-tempered.
Whereas if you felt attacked or like truly vulnerable about the things that I were writing about, it's one thing for me to tug at myself in that way, and it's another for me to sort of unravel someone else.
Yeah.
In that way. And I'm not saying I've never done it, but I am saying, like, if it's a friend I want to stay friends with.
Yeah, you don't.
Part of me, this probably points out why I want to be more of an entertainer than a literary writer, but I feel an equal responsibility to celebrate my friends rather than simply to interrogate my friends.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean I'm not going to criticize them, but I will at least try and make part of the portrait something that they will devilishly be happy with.
Yeah. I understand that. It's especially, like I said, I write mostly poems, so there's no characters, but when I do sort of outline stories, it's going to sound a bit saccharine. There's a lot of friends of mine that I have not seen in quite a while, and when I think about the characters who I want to inhabit my world, for me to use my friends as templates is in my own way to bring back all the things I missed, all the good times we had, all the rough points, things about them that I want other people to know, but in the best possible way. Like if someone was very gregarious and outgoing and, you know, stylish and distant, I would also write about the incredible complexity and intelligence and thoughtfulness and sensitivity that I saw in them. And sort of the, you know, the surface under the gilding, I would want to honor them in that way. Or if they've passed, which unfortunately is true of several friends and classmates, I would want to remember the good things about them and to remind others.
Oh.
You know.
Do me a big favor. Write my elegy now.
I will.
Right now, but.
But now, yeah.
In the next month or so.
In the next month or so. Yeah, no, I will. It'll be a wonderful, wonderful elegy. Feel free to describe me as judgy and standoffish.
So, I would say you're in love with your fabulous voice. That's what I would say. I don't think it's saccharine, but I get what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
That just to praise and celebrate the things we love seems... Well, I mean, it's what Hallmark does in usually the dumbest possible way.
Definitely.
Which is why, as poets, we think, okay, like... No. Like, we have to be black-hearted. And it's like, no, that's also not...
Yeah.
One of the biggest risks we can take, I think, is to just be open and vulnerable, including the good things,
yeah,
you know?
I agree.
Sometimes, like, risking sentimentality sometimes is, like, the most important risk.
That's true.
And you could always revise it later or just not share it if it turns out to be, like, oh, I love the way my cat looks at me. He's so innocent and goofy. Like, okay, that's... Yeah. I didn't nail that poem, turns out.
I do love the way my cat looks at me. it is very endearing. You know, and actually, I'm really, really glad you brought up the word sentimentality because Frances doesn't strike me as sentimental. Did you get that impression? She's not sentimental, but...
I would say all the characters in this story, or the our quartet of main characters, mm-hmm. or they're not main characters, but major minor characters, there's still this sense that they have to be cool, which means there are certain things they're not allowed to say, because even saying them, like, it short circuits so many different things. So Frances has this medical condition that's going to put her in constant pain, might make sex painful, it might eradicate her chances of giving birth to a child.
Endometriosis for our listeners.
And this is so shameful to her before she even knows what's going on. Like, she calls Nick from the hospital and he's like complaining that she's drunk and she's going to get him in trouble for cheating because he doesn't know she's in the hospital, and she's loopy because she's in the fucking hospital and like isn't even all there and is just calling to get some reassurance from a human being, which... If she had told him, I'm sorry, I'm calling, I'm in the hospital, I'm in a lot of pain, I don't need you to come, I just wanted you to, I wanted to hear your voice or something, which, all right, risking sentimentality.
Yes, yes.
She can't say that, so then he goes into dick mode.
He was.
Which would be understandable if she's just like, I, you know, like, I'm tired of being lonely on Saturday night, let me call Nick and ruin his life. That's a thing that happens too.
It does. It does.
It's not likely Frances would have done that. But here's the thing. Because you don't have enough open conversations, you don't know other people. Nick, like, this may be the most important sentence in the book for male readers. And so if you're a man in your 20s, understand this. Nick at one point tells Frances, I never know what you were thinking.
Yeah.
And Frances gets mad because he can't read her mind and she doesn't tell him what's on her mind. So she may not be able to have kids. Does she want kids? Early in the book, she says, you could raise a family in this house. Now, is that a declaration that she might want to raise a family in that house? I don't know. Maybe she's just even first getting used to the idea that maybe she might want that. But then she has to have this whole conversation with herself like, well, I probably can't have that. Or if I can, it's going to be really expensive and long and painful and arduous for this thing I'm not sure that I want. But now it's terrifying to know I probably just can't.
Yeah. And the thing is about the... Again, I really like what you said about you have to be cool and you can't be sentimental. Therefore, a lot of that authenticity of youth isn't really authentic because you're not allowing yourself to be vulnerable with yourself, with your friends, with your subjects, even if you're a writer. And I think it's a lot of bravery to be very uncool and to be open like that. And I've been in situations where I've seen people who don't really care about being cool, but in that moment... They are so emotionally honest. Initially, it's uncomfortable, but then it opens the gates for other people to be that way too. And that is when you truly have a great conversation.
And those are the coolest people. They don't know it, and we don't know it.
Yeah. I was not cool at all.
So you're saying you were cool by not being cool?
I don't know. I was, No, recently someone asked me, like, oh, you're such a nerd. And I was like, thank you. Thank you. That's sweet. I am. But yeah, I am glad you said that. And you feel that maybe if all of our quartet were not so wrapped up in being what they thought everyone expected them to be, a lot of heartache, literal and figurative, could have been completely avoided.
But these are lessons.
Yes.
We have to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So my senior year of high school... I reluctantly fell in love with a freshman.
Oh, it happens.
Like, we had this ridiculous tennis class together. It was like, okay, so you're mostly not doing anything. You're hanging out and talking. And I just end up talking to this girl. And she's a freshman. And so remember 21, 31, and the 31 seems ancient. It's like, okay, so 15 kind of feels like 5. I'm like, yeah, I'm not, you know, like, I'm not having any of this. And then you go off to college. And it's like, still have feelings. And so freshman year was like awkward, me trying to figure out just like what even is this relationship, if it's a relationship, and also like who am I supposed to be, who do I want to be, and all of that. So summer in between freshman and sophomore year of college, and so she was between sophomore and junior in high school. So I'm at the public library. She sees me. She gives me a hug. She kisses my neck. And then I think later that day or the next day, I give her a call and like offer her my friendship. And I'm like, I wasn't necessarily communicating what I wanted. I still, you know, still the idea, like, you're going to date a high schooler. Even though now you know, like, I'm spoken for, but at 51, like, okay, yeah, someone 4 years younger than me, it's like, that's not
well, it's
a crazy 3 years. Like, it's not a crazy gap.
Yeah,
but it meant more then, but...
Yeah.
And I don't beat myself up over, like, oh, like, did I ruin, like, I would it have worked out? Probably not. Most things don't work out.
Yeah.
But I couldn't even communicate what I felt, what I thought, or with any certainty what I wanted. And that's not even granting her any room for any of that either. She's, like, told one thing about me, and it's like, okay, I'm not sure why that information's interesting. Okay. So I still remember what it's like to feel deeply. Hmm. About someone and just not have the language or the courage to try and build that bridge just to even figure out what the whole situation's about.
Well, I think at that point, you know, between high school and college, the chasm sort of begins because someone who is 21 and they've graduated and they're maybe they like someone who's 17 who's about to go into college, like that 21-year-old is about to go into the adult world and will be making friends their age in their early 20s, maybe even older, and you have someone that no matter how much you like them and you love them, they're still a kid in their own way. You know, they're not, you know, they're not signing a lease, they're maybe not paying taxes yet, you know. They don't have all of those crippling adult things that you have right now. So yeah, when we get older, 4 years isn't that much, but at 21, 4 years is, you know, a gap. It's a huge gap. And I was thinking, you know, kind of about, you know, leaving my 30s. I think the 20s is, that's for learning the lessons. The 20s is for learning the lessons. And
oh, all the years are for learning the lessons.
Oh, yeah, all the years.
Different lessons.
Different lessons. I feel like the really important lessons are in the 20s. And with the 30s, I think there comes subtlety. I commented, it's like, now that I'm in my 30s, I know what not to say.
I need to say fuck less at work.
Yeah, I need to... I know I have a lot of internal monologues, constantly internally monologuing, which means that I guess maybe I come across as quiet or not quite in the conversation. But meanwhile, I'm thinking my own thing, kind of as, I guess, a caveat. If I'm not speaking in the middle of a very intense conversations, asking me, what do you think, Rachel? That's just, honestly, that's asking for it, but that's going to be a very loaded question at the moment. So
in my PhD years, you could always... I don't know if anyone figured this out. You could tell when I hadn't read the material. I wasn't talking.
Oh. Yeah, no, that's...
John, what do you think? You're uncommonly quiet today. Oh. I agree with Sarah. That's all I have to say.
Yes. You, who...
It's like, Sarah's not here today. I don't care. I still agree with Sarah.
I agree with her, wherever she is. And I think with Frances, like, this whole... Like, everything going on... You know, with Nick at this point, it's like just constant, endless lesson. I do have to ask you, John, what did you think of the ending? If we can spoil the ending for the readers, if they don't mind.
I don't want to spoil it exactly.
Okay, fair.
But I think it might be her best ending of the three novels so far. I suppose, and again, I think a lot of us have tripwires, like, okay, like if certain things get triggered, then like we react in a negative way. So that if something might seem sentimental or positive or optimistic, we're like, ah, bah. You know, like we all have this inner Scrooge, and it's like, no, like I can't be cool if I like that. And I feel like the novel ends in a very complicated but optimistic way, I would say.
I agree.
With a conversation with Nick and Frances, and I feel good about their relationship. Not quite as good as I felt about the relationship in Normal People. That one had a little bit more mileage. That was good by the end. But, you know, I feel like the two of them were finally able to talk like friends.
Yeah.
Which then allowed them to be more than friends.
Yeah. It's strange that I would think of that ending as being optimistic. But, you know, you're right. It is. It's sort of allowing for... sort of the emotional space that they didn't give themselves before. Do you think
they're actually talking?
Yeah, they're talking. It's
like not talking at each other. Okay, so I'm going to take a detour into the show Girls.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which turns out I hated. But season one I watched, and I was on the fence. There were things I liked. There were things I loathed. But there was a moment in which Hannah and I forget the fella she liked. But
Adam?
Adam, right, played by
Adam Driver,
Kylo Ren,
and Kylo Ren, yeah.
there's a scene where she's been bugging him or something, and they're on the street, and he just starts fucking yelling at her, and he's like, do you want me to be your fucking boyfriend? Is that what you fucking want? Is that what you fucking want? And then they're like in an Uber driving away together, and she's just smiling, the satanic, goofy-assed, childish, moronic smile, like, yes, that's the thing I wanted. And even in this hostile package, you've given me the thing I most wanted.
Yeah.
But it seems like maybe more than just wanting for him to be her boyfriend, she wanted that to happen without her asking for it or without her having to say, please be my boyfriend. So him yelling at her, you want me to be your fucking boyfriend?
Yeah.
And so I felt like that was a brilliant moment in that show. And it was like a comic moment in which I feel like that character got revealed in a way that showed both her flaws and also like was really honest and revealing of her in a way that I kind of liked.
Mm.
I feel like that show seldom reached that level of self-awareness.
Yeah.
It's like, no, here are all the horrible things that they want, and they're just going to be horrible. Yeah. And they're not even necessarily going to be that aware of how horrible they are. But we should just keep worshiping how awful they are.
Yeah,
At least that was my take on it.
Yeah.
After season two, I'm like, I can't. I watched season two not because I was thrilled to watch season two, but because there was so much misogynistic anger pointed at the show.
Mm.
And I'm like, well, I'm a dude. I'm not going to react that way. So let me watch it. And so I hated the show, but not because women were making fun of men or women had like pitying, horrible sex with men or like none of the like, oh, you know, like she's not a supermodel and like she's naked on screen. I'm like, yeah, all of these are good things to me.
Yeah.
But eventually they set up for season three. Oh, yeah, she's now going to be a student at Iowa. And I'm like, so season three is going to be about how being in Iowa's MFA program is going to let Hannah down. Like, that's what the show is going to be. I'm like, I'm out. I'm officially out. I can't do it.
Yeah.
I cannot do
it. I watched all the seasons, and everyone was, you know, there were a lot of think pieces about the unlikability of the characters. And I was like, but they're really kind of the worst on their own way. Like, in a way, it's weird. You root for them. Because they deal with, you know, bad boyfriends, bad bosses, you know, difficult parents, genuine trials and hardships. At the same time, it's like, if you met them in real life, I wouldn't say you'd run screaming in the opposite directions, but you would keep them at kind of a distance. I liked Jessa, who was actually played by Jemima Kirk, who plays Melissa in Conversations with Friends. And I feel like it's weird. I feel like, oh, it's like if Jessa got her life together, she is Melissa, if you kind of think about that. But
so she was the Brit.
She was the Brit, yeah. That's her, okay. I mean, that's a real accent, yeah. Yeah, that show was, I think the one reason why I did like it was that it was not shiny and glossy like Sex and the City. Like, the apartments were kind of awful, but they were so real in their mm-hmm. awfulness. And
no, I was rooting for the show.
Yeah, I was because
I was not happy that I didn't like the show. I wouldn't have watched season two if I wasn't hoping.
At the same time, it felt very real.
It kind of broke my heart.
It did.
But yeah, no, Sex and the City might as well have been Lord of the Rings for how real it was. Like, there's no Carrie. No, that's yeah. not an apartment. That like, there's not a midtown or uptown brownstone. Like, that's not.
Yeah. The continuity issues in that. But I kind of liked how gritty and grimy and uncomfortable the show was, because that's, I'm not saying, you know, life in your 20s is gritty and grimy and uncomfortable, but, you know, it's the world of small apartments and big ideas.
I just felt like Adam was the most likable character, which was a really bad.
Yeah, the scene where he and Jessa have a fight and tear the apartment to pieces. One, I was like, no one's calling the cops. And then I thought, you know what? That's also sadly realistic. No one's calling the cops because that apartment is in total shambles. Like, it's amazing they haven't actually killed each other. Yeah, I liked Adam.
No, I think people might have eventually called the cops.
They might have eventually called the cops when it quieted down. But yeah, when he like yanks the bookshelf, like he tears the bookshelf down. I'll say that poor person who lives below them. Yeah, and then they were screaming, and then, oh, he does that, like, the Shining thing where he hacks a hole in the door with his fist. He punches a hole in the bathroom door with his fists. I was just like, yeah, this is...
Well, he has force powers.
He does, yeah. Someone, there's this, that scene is on YouTube, and someone commented, was this his audition video for Kylo Ren? And I'm like, kind of, yeah, that's him.
So that scene from Girls that I liked a lot, though, you know, kind of demonstrated just the impossibility of Hannah saying what she wanted.
Mm. Do you feel a lot of the characters in conversations with friends have a hard time saying what they want?
That's what most of the book is about, is them trying not to. And then eventually things get so bad that things couldn't get worse. So Melissa writes that email.
Yeah.
And Bobby lays into Francis. Francis writes that story, which we don't know the full contents of, but we can imagine.
Yeah. But then again, Melissa was justified in writing that email. I mean, I thought the email was passive aggressive, but at the same time, very mature, because I think a lot of women might not have had that grace, if that's the right word, to compose that kind of email.
Composure.
Composure to compose that very passive-aggressive but honest email that showed that she saw Francis kind of, yeah.
Well, and when it's aggressive, it's clinical, which is, like, creepy.
Yeah, the clinical, oh, that's the clinical aggressiveness of that email. It's like, ooh.
And there are times when we've seen Melissa talk about Nick where we're like, anything bad Nick does is justified based on just what I'm hearing in the conversation right now, which is not a reasonable conclusion to draw. But on the other hand, you're like, wow, imagine living in which that is just part of the dynamic.
I was reading that and I was thinking, it's like, I don't think I would ever talk about Josh, my husband. I would never talk him about that way. I don't know how he talks about me to other people, but I would never in public treat him like that. Like, that was really, it's like, do you guys even like each other? I don't think Melissa and Nick like each other.
I'm sorry. I was just nodding my head. No. Well, I remember Chris Rock's comedy special before his last comedy special. He was talking about something about marriage and goes, all right, now go in there and make this bitch happy. And I'm like, he's getting a divorce.
Never watched a Chris Rock comedy special, but I believe it.
Yeah. So Tambourine was about his divorce, his latest one. But before that, just the way he's talking about her, I'm like, all right, like, part of the money that's in her bank account comes from him telling that joke on stage. And maybe she is so wise that she would think that's funny to some degree.
Yeah, to some degree.
But no, that's a, like, I don't know if he knows this or not, but he's getting a divorce. Because you can't want, like, you, can you say things like that? Sure. But I think when you say things like that, you are sabotaging the marriage, hoping it will either fix itself or die.
Yeah. And I guess the thing is, it's interesting that you say sabotage, because I wonder, has Melissa been, like, slow motion sabotaging her marriage for years, but now Nick has actually done something so unexpected, really, that far, with someone she initially didn't wholly expect to be partner in imploding that marriage, that she almost wants to make it work on principle. Is that fair? Is that fair to say?
Well, it kind of presumes she wanted it to be over, and then perversely is like, oh, you want him? Okay, now you can't have him, because technically he's mine. You can't, like, that she gets territorial just for the sake of being territorial. I wouldn't be surprised if that's part of it. There are a lot of parts to being married, and, you know, that the romantic connection's part of it. But if you're comfortably companionate with another person, yeah, like, okay, let's put a stop to that.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a really, all right, let's just start over. Like, we're in our 20s. All right, we're single now. Let's start dating. And you're like, I hated dating.
You know, I always wonder how, like, how those girls were, the ones who would get engaged their senior year of college. And, you know, you all sort of coo about the ring. And then part of me is like, why would you do that? Gets engaged right after college. It's like, you're not even knocked up. There's no excuse for this behavior. Why? But, you know, you have to wonder, like, how are they doing now? You know, it's such a formative time to explore who and what you are. And Bobby and Francis are doing that. I feel that they do evolve in the course of the book. And I do find it actually quite touching how Bobby takes care of Frances when she's very ill, when she starts manifesting the severe signs of endometriosis. I actually found that very touching. She's not squeamish. She's very nurse-like, actually, in taking care of her, which I thought was really, I liked that. That was like, okay, I like you a bit more now, Bobby. You've got this fierceness in you that's you're now utilizing to take care of your friend. But yeah, you're constantly shifting and evolving. And I kind of wonder, beyond the novel, who is Frances going to be now that she's had this huge thing happen in her life? It's such a drastic time.
Well, I would argue, you know, I don't know. I feel like I'm always evolving. I mean, in some ways, I'm never evolving because I just don't have that much emotional or mental energy. And I'm just trying to pay bills and pay off creditors. But the idea of like, oh, I'm settled now. Mm. It's okay. Now let's just comfortably ride the treadmill until I'm dead. Like, I don't know, as an artist, like I've never known an artist who's just like, yeah, I'm going to do the same thing over and over until I'm dead. Like, no, like you keep exploring, learning.
Yeah.
So, and there are people, it's like, oh yeah, like their musical interests stop when they graduate college. And then like, yeah. Okay. Let me find the pop station that plays the music from when I was in college, and yeah. That's my musical reality. And it's like, to me, that's a form of death. I just and it's couldn't.
It's a huge disservice, I think, to... Yeah, it's like, that's one thing. Whenever I hear people say, oh, there's no good music anymore. And I was like, are you just listening to the radio? Because that's probably why.
Oh, well, I don't have time. I have kids. So, I mean, maybe if you don't have kids, that you have plenty of time for that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, but then don't complain that there's no good music.
Yeah, it's like, you know, especially if, like, it's not awful. Like, if you know their taste in music, and I was like, and you say, oh, there's no good music. It's like, but then what are you listening to? I've kind of had, personally, an evolve or die approach. When you mention you constant, for me, it's sort of like, I have to evolve. No, I'm not literally dead, but sort of the...
I'm spiritually dead, but...
Yeah, I've had to evolve or die. I think just a lot of choices I've made, and not bad ones, just like, you know, about careers and relocation and what not to do. It's like, I have to change. I have to crawl out of the water, you know, grow legs, shed the scales, you know, climb down from the tree, that sort of thing. So for me, whenever, you know, you sit down and read about these characters in incredibly formative times, like even between the age of 31 and 39, that's... You go through a lot, even if your life is going well. That doesn't mean, you know, the lake is still disturbed, even if your life is going well. You experience so much to change you. So, I mean, I don't know. I know Sally Rooney's probably got a lot going on with her newest novel, but there are characters that you want to revisit because of how they're written. And I would like to see where Bobby, Frances, Nick, and Melissa are, you know, 10 years after the events of the novel. And it's already going to be 2023 in a few months. It's not unrealistic for us to want to see that.
Oh, I think I'm done.
You're done? Yeah.
Well, there's the part of me that wants to theorize the future for these characters. And so for me, reading a project like that, I would be assessing, okay, how would I do in my theorizing, which is not really what the reading experience should be about. So a lot of my distrust about projects like that has to do with just me. And case in point, Trainspotting 2.
Never saw that. Saw the original. Never saw
it. I think it was based on porno because... Irvine Welsh has written a couple of books in the sort of Trainspotting
universe.
But this one most aligns with what we remember from the film Trainspotting. Mm. And it's like, okay, so Ren comes back and he's broke. Like, he had all that money. Like, so why? How did we get? Why are we here?
Yeah.
Have we not evolved? And it's like, well, there's been a lot of failure between now and then. And even if it's understandable, there's kind of a sadness to watching characters crawl back up to get back to just where they were when they were supposed to be happy.
Yeah.
And so there's something just a little too heartbreaking about that for me.
Fair. Yeah. I think as revisiting them, it doesn't necessarily have to be like a, you know, it's not going to be a wholly happy ending.
What would be safer for me or more enjoyable for me is if like one character were involved in a new story, and then, like, I don't mind hearing about these satellite characters so long as it doesn't feel like a revisiting of the whole thing. Because it's quite logical that Nick and Melissa's relationship isn't going to be stable or similar to what it was in this book. It might be, but they might be poly, or they might have an open relationship, or something. The chances that Bobby and Frances are just, what, hanging out in a flat, like in a house? I mean, if Frances has enough going on in her life, then Bobby's too much of a gravitational pull, I think. Mm. If she's going to have her own life, she needs to be have a little bit more separation.
I feel like Bobby is someone who could very easily weigh another person down.
Which is great if the person wants that.
Yeah, but if they actually want to, you know, kind of go beyond that, it's a millstone. You don't want to be a millstone, but I could see Bobby being that, potentially.
Not that Sally Rooney is just listening, waiting to figure out what to write based on what you say.
No, I couldn't imagine, actually. The thought of Sally Rooney ever listening to me talk about her books is intimidating. I would basically sort of have to like crawl under like the table or crawl under someone and just hide, and then like with her beautiful Irish voice she can, you know, talk to me from wherever I've been hiding.
Just like, oh, Americans and their thing for the Irish accent.
Yeah, she probably just like sigh, you know. I have to say, I did like conversations with friends. I would recommend it kind of as a starting point. You know, it is her debut novel. It really explains all the others. But yeah. No, I enjoyed it. I'm glad we actually had a chance to sit down and, you know, kind of examine it just on its own. I feel that even if we read it last time and did our homework, we wouldn't really have had a chance to kind of like, you know, pick over the bones.
So some of the conversations with friends are performative and like, okay, here are the kind of hip things that people are expected to say. And mm-hmm. you've got these sort of more bougie people with the more hypothetically radical people and they're kind of talking and it's playful and occasionally barbed, but mostly, you know, flip. And then you've got the angry conversations, and then you've got the conversations where characters felt seen. And even if it's kind of a shock to learn what other people are actually thinking, that lets some good things grow in those conversations. So, all right, you've one episode of the TV show is what you watched.
Yeah.
How many conversations with friends were in Conversations with Friends, the TV show?
Well, I only saw one episode. Just the one.
Because you weren't in love with it?
This sounds weird. I wasn't really drawn in, and they changed a lot of it unnecessarily. They made unnecessary changes. I don't know why.
What part did Adam Driver play?
Oh, no, he was not in it. No, he was not in it. But you know what? If Adam Driver wants to be in a Sally Rooney novel, I'm sure they'll find a way. It was just some of the way they started. It kind of took away from the story. I think I would encourage people, watch the miniseries and then sit down with the book. I think you can enjoy the two independent of each other. And I think the changes kind of do a disservice to the dynamic.
Like what changes?
Okay, I guess I'll spoil it. Well, Melissa meets them at a spoken word event, and she even takes their photograph that night. And, you know, they have they actually talk, and they, you know, kind of get to know her. And in the adaptation, she doesn't take their photo. They don't really know she's a photographer. They know she's a writer. She talks with them for like a few moments. They mention the Irish Sea. And the next time you see them, they're swimming in the sea in the daytime, and they're going to her house to kind of, I guess, dry off, change, get ready. And it's in the daytime, so there's no dinner party. There's, you know, which happens, of course, in the book where they meet Nick. They meet Nick after a day of swimming in the Irish Sea, not in the novel. And I was like, why would you make that change? Because it's...
To put them in bathing suits?
Well, see, that's it. Like, they're briefly in suits, but then, you know, Frances is sort of standing...
So they're naked.
There's no nudity.
Oh, okay.
There's no
you
nudity.
Said they weren't in their suits, so...
Yeah, no, they're just kind of like... Frances is standing in the middle of their kitchen, and whoever their, like, set designer was, it's like it was a very... I don't say dour, but, like, I don't know. It's like charcoal paint in the kitchen. It's a very dark, darkly lit room. It's a very nice house. And there's this very strange abstract painting in the background that looks like someone took, like, a red Sharpie and went to town, which... Maybe they own, but the fact that when you first... Oh, that's another thing. They go to Melissa's house the night they meet Melissa, and they briefly meet Nick, and then they come back to dinner. But when they go into that house at night, and it's lit up, and they see how warm and beautiful and charming it is, it's like, you know, this is the fruits of the adult, quote-unquote, life, you know. And then when they go back to dinner and it cooks, and you know, there's a sunroom, it really sets up the dynamic. Whereas in the Hulu adaptation, it just feels very clunky. It's like, why would they do this? It's the change was wholly unnecessary. I would love to swim in the Irish Sea, but that does not exist in the novel. It was just, I don't know, it was pointless.
Well, you admit you didn't like the layout, the design of the house, so the Irish Sea is pretty.
The Irish Sea is very beautiful, but they changed by altering the dynamic of Melissa.
I guess, you know, part of the problem of a TV adaptation, or Hulu in this case, you know, there has to be a certain pace to it.
Yeah.
Like in a literary novel, the pace is whatever you want it to be.
Yeah, but they went like from like, you know, 90 miles an hour, you know? It's...
Here's a question. Was there a voiceover?
No, no.
So Frances's voice is...
Gone.
Gone, except for dialogue.
Yeah. She barely talks, like at all. There's...
Which is how it would be if she wasn't narrating the story.
Yeah, that's why one of the, you know, the person who was reviewing the show, who obviously knows, who did read the novel, it's like, there are no conversations with friends in this adaptation, because originally it is from her point of view. You know, she's not mute, but Nick's attraction to her feels very, in a way, natural in the book, and you could see it in this one. It's like, why? It feels... more random. It's almost like he does it just because he can, which, to be fair, you know, he does in the book, but
well, I think Frances, because she's so low-key, generally, it just, there's room for him to be who he is rather than the handsome, charming actor celebrity that people want him to be.
Yeah. He acts a lot around Melissa.
Bobby would just be a lot of work. Mm-hmm. Not that, you know, Bobby's not bi, she's gay.
Yeah.
But, right, they would be the power couple, like if somehow they could be romantically entwined, but also Bobby would be so much work that Nick would never survive, whereas, and Melissa, turns out, is a lot of work, emotional work for him.
Yeah.
He's terrified he's going to buy the wrong fucking whatever.
Yeah.
When he goes to the store.
Vegetables, yeah. His.
And Frances is not someone who would show him out. She'll chew him out for completely random and psychotic shit, but months go by.
Yeah.
Without her. And her anger comes from her not telling him what she's thinking. Or her not believing that it's safe for her to tell him what she's thinking.
Possibly, but at the same time, I feel like you could probably tell Nick what you're thinking, because he is kind of... I don't want to say passive, but...
Well, that's part of the problem, though. If he's too passive, and it's like, well, then what's the fucking point? If I'm telling you and nothing matters, then why tell you?
It's not so much being afraid to tell, but just like, what's the point?
Yeah.
What's the point? It's not going to matter anyway. At the same time, though, he's very... he feels less passive with Frances as the novel goes on. As it goes on, he feels less... He is very much himself with her, and I think that person, I mean, yes, it could be, you know, because they're having this affair and it's very keyed up and it's emotionally very fraught, but I feel like with Frances, at least on some level, he can breathe, which I don't get that from his home life with Melissa. I think he has to act a lot when he's with Melissa. He's constantly acting, you know. He never goes off stage. If that makes sense. Yeah.
Which is exhausting.
It is. It is. That's why a lot of actors, they can be quite, you know, once they're off stage and once they're, you know, not in front of the camera.
They're off. Yeah.
They're off. They are off. And with Frances, he can be off, but then also be more self-possessed, at least in some cases. So.
Yeah. Well, I think adaptations of literature, it's so difficult. It is so difficult to get them to work, in part because visuals are so overpowering in their way. Mm. Like, I don't know who's playing Frances, but here's the thing. Like, how pretty is she? Is she plain? Is she classic? Is she elegant? Is she just... Is she this question mark? And you're like, oh my God, who is that mysterious woman? And it's like, once you show me the actor, it's like, most of the enigma's gone, just because
I do think that I do like
the, I know what the person Frances, looks like though. In clothes,
yeah,
and it's like, oh, okay, so that's who that is. Like in Angela's Ashes, Frank McCourt through the whole book describes the terrors of poverty, but in the film you just see an Irish street and an Irish apartment in a slum, and you're like, oh, why don't they just go and slit the throat of every fucking store owner and rich person they can find? Like, all the description in Angela's Ashes, where you just see it, and instantly I'm like, oh, blow the place up right now.
Yeah.
Blow everything the fuck up right now. Because that's what happens, like when you could just see it. And so I am surprised they didn't go with a voiceover. It's a difficult thing, I know, to keep up. Is the show an hour long or a half hour?
I think they're about half an hour. There's 12 episodes. So, yeah, I think they're about half hour each.
Yeah, I would have kept some voiceovers.
Yeah, because she just kind of comes across as very muted. And while Frances is more, you know, taciturn than Bobby, she's not mute. She's not, you know, they give her this passiveness that she does not have in the novel. And again, it's a disservice to the story, to the character. I don't think there's anything passive in Frances. Not really. I don't know if you see her differently.
Well, a little passive. I mean, that's what she shares with Nick, which is why, like, she expects Nick to read her mind. Like, that's a form of passivity.
It is. It is. Sort of expect.
Although, it's also just emotional naivety. Like, I'm feeling this. I'm here. Why can't you feel this? And it's like, because I can't read your mind. Can you read my body language? I'm like, you're sitting in a chair. You know, like, I'm really hungry. I can't afford this apartment. Like, if you told me anything, I could have emotions or thoughts or something, but yeah, that being expected to read someone else's mind because they don't think they should have to express themselves, or they can't articulate exactly what they want, in part because they might have to admit what they want. I want you to leave your wife and just be my little husband, like in my own little domestic oasis. Like, that's a horrible thing to want, because I proclaim every day not to want the exact opposite of that and to annihilate the patriarchy. And yet part of me wants the thing that I'm judging Melissa for.
Yeah.
Like, part of me wants exactly that.
Yeah.
Which means I have to process that, but I don't want to process that. But why don't you just break through all of that confusion and just tell me that you're going to leave your wife so that we can have the perfect life together? At which point I could go, why did you think that? Like,
yeah. Well, they even call early on in the novel, they call Nick a trophy husband.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, he's a total trophy husband. Like, there's no way he has any actual substance. You know, clearly we can see why Melissa's with him.
They didn't use the word mimbo, but
No, he's not quite a mimbo. No, not at all, actually.
Yeah, no, I think the book is fabulous, and I am impressed how Sally Rooney keeps covering, I would say, the same themes, and they don't feel samey.
No, they don't. Not at all.
And she's expressed where, you know, her character in Beautiful World, Where Are You? Is suggesting, all right, I might be done writing. And I think there is something valuable in artists who only come out to say something when they clearly have something to say. Hmm. So if Sally Rooney's done forever or for a while, like, that's totally fine. But I appreciate how she's making sure that she gives us good storytelling value each time out. And so that if you like the kinds of characters and things that she's writing about, like, it's all going to be worth it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all going to be memorable and a special reading experience. And so each one is different enough for us to feel like it's been a different experience.
You know, she knows that what she's writing about is not new, but she keeps it fresh and relevant and moving. And I think a lot of her readers, even if they don't see themselves, they see the situation, they see others, and, you know, the light bulb goes off in their head. But yeah, she is not afraid to get, when I say, like, down and dirty, to really get to the heart and soul of her characters. She's not concerned with making them likable, I think. And that's, for me, that's a hallmark of a good writer. So they're not concerned about making them likable or popular or aspirational, but at the same time, again, it's like the cool, not cool thing. You're more invested in them because of that.
She's more interested that her characters are interesting than likable.
Exactly. Which, oddly enough, of course, makes them likable because they're interesting.
Well, that is the show this week. I would like to thank Rachel Tillman, Chelsea Alice for editing this episode, and of course, our sponsor, Scripophile. If you like the Drunken Odyssey's content, maybe think about going over to YouTube and subscribing to our YouTube channel. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including perfect advice from Dr. Perfect, comic book reviews from Drew Barth, and reviews of schlock films by our own curator of schlock, Jeff Schuster. All right, gang, until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Never mind, John. Pass me the bottle.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.